Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The world isn't wide enough. Get immersed in the expansive views of the 48-inch customizable panoramic display in the all-new 2024 Lincoln Nautilus Hybrid. Explore more at Lincoln.com. Some models, trims, and features may not be available or may be subject to change. Check with your local retailer for current information. Lincoln and Nautilus are trademarks of Ford or its affiliates.
Looking to refresh your closet, home, or beauty routine this spring? Walmart's got all the stylish goods in one stop. From chic new looks and the latest makeup to quality furniture and tableware. Go to walmart.com/nowtrending. That's walmart.com/nowtrending for the hottest fashion, home, and beauty finds. Your style at Walmart.
Welcome to the Bike Radar podcast, brought to you by the team behind BikeRadar.com, Cycling Plus, and MBUK magazines. If you enjoy this episode, please subscribe. And if you can do so, leave us a rating on your podcast provider of choice. It really helps us reach other cyclists like you. Hello, welcome to the Bike Radar podcast. My name's Tom Marvin, Senior Technical Editor here at BikeRadar.com and MBUK magazine. Joining me through the relative magic of Microsoft Teams, we've got Tom Law. He is our Bike Radar YouTube mountain bike presenter. How's it going, Tom?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks, mate. How are you?
Very well, thank you. And we also have Nick Clark. He is Bike Radar's digital writer, also on the mountain bike side of things. How's it going, Nick?
Yeah, not bad, thanks, Tom.
Excellent. Nick, what have you been up to recently? What's fun? What's popping? What's hitting all your spots? What's going on?
Well, things hitting all my spots is probably our amazing trip out shooting for MBUK, where we got attacked by helicopter gunships and Chinooks on Salisbury Plain, which was very interesting, but unfortunately, I think we missed the money shot, didn't we? We went a bit too early.
We missed the money shot. We found the up on Salisbury Plain, obviously they do a lot of military training, and we found a few helicopters were circling and landing on a landing strip, and the rest of the photographer got very excited about the possibility of having a Chinook taking off over our heads as we looked epic on our XC bikes. But it all happened a bit too quick and we missed the shot.
Yeah, a shame. But there must be something good in the can. Fingers crossed, anyway.
I've seen the pictures. There's a couple of cool little bits and pieces. you had a good day on a photo shoot then, you enjoyed it?
Yeah, really good. Lapped at the sun and getting that base tan in for summer now.
Base tan, you mean you burnt to a crisp, Nick?
Yeah.
I saw you.
You could say that.
There was a little salmon in my van on the way back to Bristol.
I tell you what, I've been peely today, but what can you do? Part of the fun.
The exuberance of youth. Tom, what about you? What have you been up to recently?
Well, I've just about recovered from our group ride that we had with the Bike Radar guys after I stacked it on that infamous one last run of the day, making up some lost time with that in the Peak District. And I've been away on a trip recently with work to test some new stuff in a country that I was not expecting to give me 25 degree heat and sunstroke either. So that was nice, an unexpected surprise.
Dreamy, lovely stuff. I'm all right, thanks for asking, guys.
What have you been up to, Tom? Nick, we always seem to forget this.
We always forget this.
I briefly sort of asked Tom how he was earlier, but then we always forget to
I'm all good, thanks. I've just finished, very apt for what's coming up in this podcast, a cross-country bike test for MBUK. I've also just come back from a cross-country bike launch in Colorado, which was great. That was the Pivot Mac 4 SL, which you'll be able to see on Bike Radar as we speak, and listen to watch a video about it as well on our YouTube channel. But yeah, no, all good. Enjoying the sun. It's very nice that it's not raining right now for the whole of the bank holiday weekend, which is coming up. Right then, let's move on. Now, as slightly kind of hinted to there, this podcast is all about the world of cross-country racing. Now, following the first round of the XC World Cup in Novi Mesto, young Nick wrote an excellent article on bikerella.com titled Eight Defining Features of an XC World Cup Bike in 2023. And we thought, given that this weekend is the second round of the XC World Cup in Lenzerheide, we would do a little bit of a podcast talking about the world of cross-country in 2023 and what you might expect to see on a World Cup XC bike this year. So, without further ado, let's look at point number one of eight. It is fair to say that in recent years, with the ever gnarlier nature of cross-country racing, especially at courses like Novi Mesto, which is famous for being very rooty, very rough, that full suspension bikes dominate. Tom, what's your thought on full sus XC bikes? Why might they dominate? What are their good bits? And perhaps, what are their bad bits?
I think they're so well-rounded nowadays. Like, we've got some other points that we'll discuss later that helps with their capability. But yeah, the courses are getting so technical. You know, they demand a full suspension bike, you know, to help the riders, you know, go as quick as they can. You know, they, a lot of it's to do with fatigue as well. Obviously, a hardtail may be a smidge quicker on certain courses, but if it's more fatiguing, then you might end up actually going slower. So I think it's that combination of that additional capability and also that little bit of extra comfort, just because the guys are taking a real rough ride down some of this stuff these days.
I guess we've seen maybe not massive jumps in the last year or two, but over the past sort of 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years, jumps as well in sort of full suspension efficiency. Obviously, back in the day, you know, if you're pounding on the pedals and your suspension is bouncing up and down, that's robbing a lot of watts. But these days, certainly on a lot of the cross-country bikes I've ridden recently, they're actually, even when they're fully open, still pretty efficient machines. Nick, I know you've been riding, well, you rode the new Specialized Epic recently. We'll go on to suspension travel later on, because I think that's interesting. But how did you find the Epic when it wasn't locked out?
When that full gulp mode, kind of really good. So the pedal efficiency was really good. And I'd probably say it was likened to, what it felt to me was sort of like a Topstone, a little bit of give in the rear stay, but nothing. Pedal bob was pretty much all gone, rode really well. Mm-hmm. And you can see, like, sort of in those interchangeable conditions where you would go for a hardtail or a full sus, that would probably tick the boxes. Mm-hmm. But on that same point, I'd also say, you know, looking at Novi Mesto, we did see Martin Videre riding the old Epic, so whether he found the same advantage, it's hard to say.
Yeah, okay. And the old Epic had the brain shock, it had longer travel, and it was sort of obviously a much more traditional XC race bike.
Yeah, rather than this replacing hardtail Epic that Specialized has just brought out.
Yeah, well, I'd say we'll dip into the Epic later on, because it is a very interesting bike. One thing I found on recent XC bikes as well is bikes seem to go down the route of either having like a really efficient, natural feeling open mode on their suspension, thanks to, you know, suspension linkages, or they've got very effective lockouts. I'm thinking like the Orbea Oise, for example, it's got this squid lock. And there's obviously other examples out there whereby like you have a two or three position lockout on the bar, which becomes really useful for, you know, those uphill sort of sections where you'll put it into the medium or the sort of medium firm mode for a bit of give at the back, or you can fully lock it out for those for the sprints or for tarmac sections as well, and then obviously fully open it out for all the performance on the way down. One of the developments in XC over the last couple of years is obviously the introduction of the XC Eliminator race, which takes place before the XCO. It's part of the gridding process. You do get points. Not all the racers are invited into that race. Now, we saw something relatively interesting happening with the new Cervelo full suspension bike at Novi Mesto in the XC race. Do you want to explain maybe what that was?
Yes, obviously Cervelo have recently released the ZFS5, which is their new full suspension bike. But they actually replaced the shock with a, what looked like a 3D printed aluminium shock shuttle almost, you know, sort of to make it basically a hardtail effectively. It kept the sagged geometry of the stock bike, so it wasn't sort of altering the geometry too much. But yeah, for that super short, intense 20 minutes or so of racing where efficiency is key, you're not too bothered about comfort, interesting workaround of the rules, because the rules state that you have to use the same bike for both events. So it allows them to use effectively a hardtail for the for the Eliminator or the short course, and then they can just wham the shock back in for the XCO. So interesting to see what the UCI think of that, and whether they'll play their usual game and look for closing that loophole.
I loved it when that I saw that. I'm a big fan of people bending rules for advantage, as long as they're within the rules. And as you say, like you know, if it had been dry on the Saturday and raining on the Sunday, obviously the UCI wouldn't be like, well, you have to use your super fast rolling tires on a muddy course. You know, they would never say that. So presume, like, how, at what point does that line blur between changing a shock? Is that any different to changing a tire? I think it's really interesting. And I enjoyed seeing that, because I'm pretty sure it ruffled some feathers, and I'm all for ruffling a feather or two every now and again.
Yeah, it was definitely an interesting development.
I wonder if more people might end up doing that as well. And as you say, set for the sagged position as well. Again, if you put thought into it, obviously the correct way to do it. Sagged position is the dynamic position on the bike. That's what you're going to be riding on. It's what it's going to feel like, and obviously helps keep that head angle a little bit slacker as well. Yeah, pretty cool. All right, let's move on to the second one. Now, Nick, you've claimed in your article that top tube mountain shocks have taken over. And I guess I would add to that, top tube mountain shocks with flex stay rear ends have taken over. Do you want to explain what you mean by this and why it might be the case?
It just seems to be the position that many manufacturers are putting their shock now. There's very few exceptions. One of the main reasons, I think, for this, especially like on marathon courses, fitting two bottles in that front triangle. But I also think it could just be, you know, the ultimate iteration of a bike frame, possibly, following those hardtail sort of lines. I don't know. We've seen a lot of it. Every new bike seems to be with it. I think for the BMC four strokes being updated, that used to be a vertical shock and by the rear, but they've obviously had to make space there. So yeah, I would probably, okay. And Pinarello's new Dogma as well. But that's an interesting one, because it's got the adjustable, adjustable shock mounts on the top. So mm-hmm. You can run it in different mill.
Different travel options. Yeah. Okay, and the flex stay. So what is the point of a flex stay, Tom? What is it? Why would it have it? Why is it particularly prominent on an XC bike?
So on a normal full suspension bike, either a linkage actuated single pivot or specialised with their FSR system, you'll have a physical pivot on either of those. So flex stay basically eliminates that to save weight, and it uses flex tuned into the carbon or aluminium to take up the place of that pivot. So obviously the key beneficiary of that is it's a lighter system. I've heard numbers, you know, sort of between 150 to 200 grams that it saves, which when you're looking for 50 grams here or there, that's a big chunk of weight to save. So I think that's why we've seen it rise in popularity, not just on XC bikes, but like even your long-term Merida, Tom, running that flex stay system. So not just limited to XC bikes. So I think just less weight, less maintenance, and it doesn't seem to, in my experience anyway, affect the suspension action too much. So I think if you can get away with running it like that, why not do it?
Quite often you find that those flex stay bikes do pedal relatively well for some reason. There seems to be, it's not that they're insensitive, but they seem to be a bit stiffer off the top, to use a cliche term. So pretty well suited to XC bikes. Back in the day when they first sort of started getting the flex stay, there was often a little question over the control of the rebound from the shock, because obviously there's some twang in that carbon that naturally pulls it back a little bit faster than you want. But it seems that actually, you know, as I say, the ones I've ridden recently, in recent years, they don't seem to have any particularly untoward suspension feels. Now, countering that, I guess, would be obviously pivots. Mac 4SL, there's information about that on Bike Radar. They've kept their DW link. One of the interesting things that they said about keeping the DW link, which is, so you have a solid front triangle, you have a solid rear triangle, and they're joined by two co-rotating links, and they kept their vertical shock position on that. And they said that by keeping the shock low, you bettered the weight distribution of the frame. And also by keeping all of the linkages towards the rear end of that front triangle, it meant that they were able to better tune the front triangle stiffness, because it was a bit more independent from the suspension linkages. They got around the whole two bottle cage issue by slinging a bottle cage mount underneath the top tube. And they claim you can get two full-size bottles in there. I didn't have a chance to try that. You can also sling a third underneath the down tube, so you can carry three bottles on that bike. But whether you would or not is a different matter. But as you say, I think, you know, I have friends who buy, you know, when they're buying their XC bikes, and they really look for that double bottle cage capability for those marathon roads. It's yeah, interesting and important. But yeah, just feel like a lot of XC bikes, they do all look quite similar.
Yeah, it's the same silhouette, just a different branding. And for some example, what do you think of the new Chevelle and the Santa Cruz? Too similar, or?
Well, I mean, they are sibling brands. They're both owned by the same people. There was obviously when Cervelo launched that bike, there was a lot of people saying, oh, they've just borrowed the same molds from Santa Cruz. And I think if you actually look at the tube shapes and tube profiles, they're obviously not the same.
Yeah.
Very similar, but not the same, which does mean that, you know, being a carbon mold, they are different molds. So they're not the same mold. I think we can safely say that. Maybe there's a bit of cross learning going on between the two companies, or maybe that silhouette is just the best silhouette for XC bikes with current production techniques and suspension. I don't know.
Yeah, it does seem to work quite well.
Yeah, maybe that's it. Right, let's move on. Increased fork travel. Now, this goes back again to that discussion we had earlier on about tracks getting more and more technical. So we're seeing more and more bikes this year coming out with 120mm suspension at the front, or maybe 110mm in terms of the Giant Anthem, 110mm on that. Obviously, there's still plenty of bikes coming with 100mm as well, but back in the day, 100mm was like the go-to amount of travel for an XC bike, but it seems to be changing. Nick, any thoughts on this? Do you like XC bikes with more travel at the front, or would you like that slammed front end, underbiked perhaps on the more technical courses, but lighter weight? What's your take?
More travel every day of the week.
That's more travel every day of the week, right? Okay.
Yeah. Well, it's more of a pain to take up to the hill, but, you know, if you're racing at the top and right at the limit, you want a bit more security on the descents and be able to push it a bit hard around the corners. If you can make up time on the descents, it's just as valuable as making it up on the hills. And I think looking at some of the Stepcaster technology on sort of like those Fox 34s, you're not adding too much weight, really. And, you know, you've ridden the Orbea Oise, which is, what, 120mm at the front? And that's, again, a bike that's way more capable than a lot of bikes on 100mm, whatever the geometry is. So that Specialized Epic Evo World Cup I was riding was 110 and 80mm at the rear. And the geometry helped it, but it still fit. I mean, I got into trouble on a rock section, which Tom kindly pointed out in the launch video for that, because there was just not enough travel to go through it. I find it difficult. I think I probably would take more travel every day.
Tom, we're seeing increased fork travel paired with increased rear wheel travel as well. So the Orbea Oise, for example, 120mm. The new Pivot Mac 4SL, that's an interesting bike. I'm not going to bang on about it too much because there's loads of information online, but that has four travel options from 95 up to 115, depending on the models you buy, and the flip chip in the Rocker Link. Do you think, are you in agreement with Nick that more travel on XC bikes is a good thing? Or are you harking back to the old school days where 80 to 100mm at the back and 100mm at front?
I think the bikes are so efficient nowadays and the weight difference is so minimal that why wouldn't you have that extra travel? I mean, a good example is in a recent video I was riding my dad's old 2005 Rocky Mountain. So it's a 26-inch 100mm travel cross-country bike with a period RockShox SID, so 32mm stanchions, 26-inch wheels. Compared to the latest 35mm RockShox SID Ultimate, it's only 80 grams lighter. Despite the fact it's loads smaller, it's quick release axle, you know, like put the two side by side, you'd think it's impossible for them to weigh basically the same. So I think that when the weight penalty is that minimal, why wouldn't you have it, especially when the courses are so technical that you're gonna be needing that stiffness, as Nick says. You know, if you're gonna be saving yourself some time in the corners, you're probably not gonna be losing it thanks to 80 grams on the fork. So, yeah, for me, I'm completely in agreement. I think it's just the way that things are going to go. I don't see them getting any longer than 120, but who knows in the future? We possibly said that about 100mm 10 years ago.
I guess probably will still be those shorter travel options out there. You know, if you're a smaller, lighter rider, for example, maybe you don't want to be dragging that much travel up and down the hill, especially if it's coming in the form of a burlier fork, like a 34 step cast. You could drop down to 100mm, get a SID SL, or a 32 step cast, you're probably not going to be pushing that towards its limits, because maybe if you're only weighing 60 kilos, maybe you don't need that. I mean, we all sadly way north of 70 odd kilos. So maybe we benefit from it more, and maybe some of the sort of the taller, more powerful riders out there as well probably are benefiting from that extra travel, that extra burliness that comes with those longer travel forks, and can get away with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, definitely. Yeah, and you're unfortunately you're absolutely right about the us being over 70 kilos, but again, like the launch that I was on, like some of the terrain was, it was tough, you know, like I was hitting some big old drops on what was basically an XC race bike and some gnarly rock gardens as well. So I definitely want to be chucking, you know, a old school sort of, you know, back in the day when SIDS had 28 mil stanchions, you know, let alone 32s. So yeah, for me, I just think that the course is just getting so tech now and the riders are pushing that hard. Yeah, I think it's a good thing. But you're quite right with the lighter riders, they can sort of get away with that 32 still, as it's not a noodle by any stretch of the imagination. No. But for the slightly heavier guys, obviously it's all relative. Yeah, that extra burliness and bit of extra travel, it's a nice way to go.
I've been riding these XC hardtails recently, and they're all 100 mil. They're all slightly more traditional as well, and I think we'll come on to maybe some of the differences between hardtails and full suspension in a later point. I'm just checking my notes, and yes, we will. But they're all coming, yeah, with 100 mil at the front. Two of them, I've got three different forks on three different bikes, actually. I've got a Lefty Ocho 100 mil. There is a SID with 100 mil, but in the 35 mil stanchion version, so it's not a SID SL, and Fox's 32 Stepcast. I rode them all yesterday, and while that 32 Stepcast is on paper the lightest, well, I don't know if it's lighter than the Archer, but it is, like, in inverted commas, the lightest, flexiest fork out there. It really wasn't holding anything back, and of those three forks, by far and away my favourite.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
Right, we'll move on to our next point, which is dropper posts are all but standard. Nick, would you like to explain your thinking behind this one? And maybe we'll talk about the nuance in that in a minute afterwards.
Well, you've seen a lot of riders riding with dropper posts now. And, you know, for a long time, XC was holding back a bit, claiming those weight savings on the hills for, again, slower descending. Well, less maneuverable descending. But I think with BMC's four-stroke including a dropper post in the frame on their flagship, like, that's saying that even the brands are thinking it's the best way. And there's no way why you wouldn't. I mean, we've been riding droppers for years, and we know it had so much dynamic riding that you wouldn't get on a rigid post.
I guess that argument of weight is relevant in some spaces. So they're going to add, what, 300-400 grams as a minimum, even for like the lightest ones, like a Fox Transfer SL, you know, it's still a relatively heavy post compared to a rigid one. So if you are trying to save those grams for a smoother, less technical course, we still see a bit of a mix, but I'd agree, like Novio Mesto, for example, we'll still see the majority on drop posts. Maybe if you go to, what, Alpstat, perhaps? A bit smoother, a bit less technical. Maybe you'll still see a few rigid posts there, just saving those weights, because it's got real punchy, steep climbs at Alpstat, and I think weight is key there. There was an old adage of, what was it? A race is won on the climbs and lost on the descents, being basically you can make up loads of times on the climbs if you're really strong, but on the descents, you're obviously going to lose it if you crash, and you don't want to do that. So maybe that's where the drop posts are coming on. People are realising that actually, A, there is maybe some more time to be made on those descents if you are one of the absolutely pinned descenders. And we can see some of those coming through in the field now, like some of the absolutely incredible riders, Tom Pidcock, for example. Yeah. And getting that post, getting that saddle dropped, even if it's like 75 mil, 100 mil out the way, does make a difference on those slightly taller, slightly sketchier feeling XC race bikes.
I think that BMC auto drop is amazing, though. Like the fact that it goes up and down, that must save so much time, especially if you're in the heat of a battle. And even going up my local fire road, going up and down the saddle takes a bit out the legs. Being able to just operate it without having to sit down just seems like a no-brainer for me.
100%. Do you know how it works?
It's got a air system in the barb, but I don't know how it works inside the post.
So I think there's, yeah, so there's two air springs in there, I think. One, Tom, do you know better than me? I'm going off what we wrote on site a few weeks ago that I read. Go on.
Yeah, so it has a valve at the base of the seat post, sort of just above the bottom bracket, which you can charge. Then it basically sucks the post down into its travel, then uses that air to pump it back up again. But it does run out of air. So you can probably, it will last for probably one sort of long race, but then that's it. It loses the auto drop feature, but once you have depleted all of that stored up air, you can use it as a regular dropper post. Mm-hmm. So you're not just stuck with a fixed post that you then just have to sit on it. And interestingly, don't want to give too much away, but I had an opportunity to speak to somebody who has used the BMC auto drop post for the last couple of years. And he said that at a course like Novomesto, if he was coming into a section before he was using it, he would stop pedaling about 10 meters before he got to an obstacle where he felt the need to use it. On the auto drop post on the BMC, he's literally pedaling to the point that he drops the post and then drops into the descent. So he said it saves an awful lot of time, and fatigue as well. It's like, can you imagine having to basically do possibly 20 or 30 squats a lap while your legs are filled with lactic acid? Takes, you don't think about it, but it takes a lot of energy to do that. So you're saving time from the fact that you can pedal for longer before you feel the need to drop it, and you're saving energy because it's dropping out of the way for you and you're not having to do all those squats. So I think we'll see more of that. I think
I'd say it's probably one of the more interesting developments in sort of any product launched recently. Actually, I'm really stoked for it. It's kind of that funny thing of, like, you know, when SRAM launched Access, their wireless drivetrains, and you moved from having to push a cable through a cable outer to just pressing a little actuator button. Same with Shimano's DI2, actually. You know, it's like, does it really matter? And like, on the face of it, like, it's not much effort to, especially with a fresh, clean system, to change gear with a cable. But pressing a button, if you're doing it lots and lots of times, there is something that is less fatiguing about it. There is something that all those little things that add up to make your life a bit easier, where you have to put less physical effort into doing something, has a real benefit when you're actually racing. There's obviously a trade-off, because if that auto drop thing weighed 500 grams, for example, would you want to add 500 grams to your bike for the sake of not having to sit down to drop it? But yeah, certainly an interesting one. I don't know how much it weighs. I don't think it obviously is 500 grams, but as a mental game to play with yourself, like, at what point does it become obstructive rather than prostructive? And I've just made that word up, but I think it works.
It's a beauty.
Yeah, that was smooth.
I think, looking back on our mate Pidcock, without the four-stroke being the bike that he chose to ride, I think that sort of, unfortunately for Pinarello, sort of screams its praise too much. If you're allowed open source of any bike in the pit, then, and you pick that, you're choosing something that is necessarily giving you a big advantage.
Well, I guess he didn't have the option to race a Pinarello full stress in the previous years.
No, as much as he wanted to.
Perhaps, yeah. I mean, obviously, he's done pretty well on it. I mean,
yeah.
The whole Novomesto thing with Pidcock was pretty incredible. What was it? He found out very shortly before the XC Eliminator that he was racing. And I was watching the run-up footage from it, and, like, literally, you've got I think it's 40 people in an XCE. And 38 of them were, like, all lined up, like, ready to go, all, like, real revved up and everything, probably taking their all their XYZs, I don't know what they take. And then, like, you just sort of saw Pidcock just, like, roll up to the back. He sort of sat, like, 5-10 meters off the back of the crowd, and then the lights changed, and he just disappeared. He just went off. He went. It was really, really beautifully impressive. I was pretty stoked about the whole thing. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, great rider.
It'll be interesting this weekend in Lenzerheide to see how he goes there. If he's racing, although he probably isn't racing, is he? Love to see the start list. Anyway, last note on dropper posts, because I realise we are rattling on a little bit longer than I planned to for this podcast. Again, going back to sort of hardtails. So you might choose a hardtail on a less technical course, one with maybe some steeper, punchy climbing, but less technical descents. And here, if you look at the world of XC hardtails that are on sale for World Cup racing, you don't see many dropper posts. And I think that is probably because if you're picking a hardtail, it's a less technical course, you're picking a hardtail to save weight and boost efficiency, and therefore maybe you're not going to have a dropper post. None of the bikes in my test, they're all recent bikes They've all got 27.2 posts, which is less dropper friendly, though obviously not impossible, and none of them have dropper posts. So there we go. Just throwing that swing ball in there.
I mean, they are basically gravel bikes these days, aren't they?
XC don't even say it. Get out, Tom. Get out. That's a podcast for another day, but gravel bikes are not XC mountain bikes, and they're certainly not mountain bikes from the 1990s, and I will defend them to my death. I will not have such chat on my podcast. Right.
I like to throw a social hand grenade into the mix every now and again, you know. I'm normally quite quiet and reserved, but every now and again, I just start lobbing hand grenades in.
Dear me, we might get an email to podcast@bikeradar.com. And if you too think Tom needs to be shot for saying such a thing, please email us. Right, we'll move on. More capable geometry. Now, I feel this one should have come higher up your list, Nick. And again, it ties into that thing we've been talking about through the whole podcast, that cross-country is no longer people razzing around a grassy field. They are now hitting technical sections with rock gardens, with roots, with drops, with loose corners and everything. And we are seeing more capable geometry. When we say more capable geometry, what do we mean by that, Tom?
So in terms of more capable geometry, I hate using the term, but it's the whole longer, lower and slacker thing. So the bikes have got longer in terms of their reach numbers, the wheelbases and the head angles have got slacker. You can also add steeper in there, weirdly, because obviously the trend now is for steeper seat tube angles as well. We had a very good, I'm going to plug myself here, had a very good video on the channel recently where, again, compared my dad's 2005 Rocky Mountain Elements to the current 2023 version with some very non-scientific timed runs and had a look at the geometry. And it was quite stark. I mean, there's obviously nearly 20 years between those bikes. But the head angle was 6 degrees different. So it was really? a 71.5 degree head angle on my dad's bike, which when you've got a 100mm travel fork and you're bottoming it out, that gets even steeper, yep. Which was mildly terrifying to say the very least. And yeah, just the rest of the geometry. So longer reach on the newer bike by about 50mm. The stem was 50mm shorter on the new bike. The handlebars were way wider. So I think it's a wider, you know, sort of trend, really. Obviously, the geometry is one thing, but there's also the stem and the handlebar that come into that as well. Because it was a 600mm wide bar on my dad's bike or something scary like that. So way narrower than I'd be used to. So yeah, I think the geometry is a big thing. And that really highlighted it for me, taking two bikes that, granted, a fair way apart in their time period, but oh god, the old bike was mortally terrifying to ride. There's no other words for it.
Shall we throw some numbers into the mix then? So, like you say, I mean, cross country, possibly like road, has always been a little bit more traditional. So it's taken longer for this long, low, slack thing to come on board than it has on enduro and trail bikes. But I agree. I feel like the world of XC has now pretty well caught up. They're never going to be as long and low and as slack as a full-on enduro bike, because they still need that snappy, reactive handling. Let's throw some numbers into the mix. I reckon like a size large on a full sus, we're quite often now seeing 475mm reach, maybe 480 at a push, 470 to 480. Head angles, 67, 67.5. It isn't now uncommon on some of the later, sort of maybe more progressive XC race bikes. Seat angles, they're still going to be a bit slacker than, you know, the most up-to-date enduro bikes. We're not going to be seeing 79 degrees. Probably are going to be seeing 60, 76, 77 degrees, simply because an XC bike has less travel. It's going to sag less, so that dynamic geometry is going to still have a relatively steep seat angle because it's not sagging 30 mil into its travel, for example. And yeah, and 29-inch wheels, of course, which are now utterly dominant in the world of XC.
Yeah, I don't think we'll be seeing any mullet XC bikes anytime soon, because it kind of defeats the point of the object.
It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen, is it? Let's move on. This next point, a sea of carbon fibre. Nick, if you'd asked me, I'd have said we've had a sea of carbon fibre for quite a long time in XC racing, but do you think there's space for other materials to come into play?
I hope so, because it is a wash with carbon. I'd love to see some materials like even some super fancy high-end aluminium, or, you know, even magnesium, or dare I say it, graphene.
Wow, the next, wow. The unexplored frontiers.
Mm. The promised land, so they say. Mm. 1 micron thin, wow.
Cool.
But yeah, it's been carbon for a while now, hasn't it? And I think it's here to stay. as much as we sometimes see, you know, especially in like crit race and even some sort of Brit series, you see an aluminium bike coming into the road race and in XC, carbon for life. But I think it's more frame design than anything else. I mean, lightness comes into it, but the design and the compliance they're putting into these bikes is certainly due to the material they're using.
I suppose it's quite easy to engineer, as I say, a bit of compliance. Well, stiffness in the right place, compliance in the right place, and those tube shapes and the tube profiles and all that sort of thing is perhaps in some ways a little bit easier to do with carbon and keep the weight as low as you can. Tom, any thoughts on frame materials for XC bikes? Can you see anything coming out in the future, or do you think that sea of carbon fibre is going to be an ocean of carbon fibre for the next few years?
I think it probably will. The main thing is just going to be the cost. Obviously, 3D printing is getting bigger and bigger all the time, but it is still prohibitively expensive. But I do think that carbon is going to be the main sort of thing. Although, interestingly, I noticed that Acto 5, their new iTrain, it's not really an XC bike, but it's sort of similar to Poly. So they CNC machine two halves of the front triangle and basically bond them together effectively. And they're claiming it's just 1.2 kilos for the front end, which is pretty light for an aluminium bike, which can take up to a 140mm fork. So maybe as aluminium technology continues to grow, we might see that. Obviously, magnesium, what, pretty much every fork lower on the market nowadays is still magnesium. I think it was it Merida back in the day did a magnesium frame.
I had a scandium frame built by Kona.
Yeah, I was going to mention scandium. Yeah, several friends had scandium Kona and Rocky Mountain frames. Yeah, I think one mate had a scandium Rocky Mountain Vertex. It was like 8.5 kilos or something stupid and like that.
Sparks would fly when you hit the deck with that, I bet.
Yeah, don't let them catch fire. Magnesium, anyway.
Cool. All right, our next one on the list is, like it or loathe it, headset cable routing is here to stay. Now, we're not going to spend too long on this because that is an entire podcast in itself. And in fact, it has been a YouTube video in itself on the new MBUK vertical. And I did that with Will Soph. Headset cable routing, I feel most people loathe it from a working on it point of view. From an aesthetic point of view, maybe more people like it. But I think I'd agree, it's here to stay. There are numerous advantages, numerous costs. But we're not going to go into it too hard. A very quick summary. Nick, love it or loathe it?
I think one of the commenters on the article summed it up perfectly with it only being the place for cable, internal headset cable routing. On the actual bikes that people buy, it's more pain than it is pleasure. But no, if you've got someone else looking after your bike while you're racing it around, then yeah, it probably helps.
It certainly helps make a strong argument for SRAM's Axis drivetrains. That's all I'm saying.
And wireless brakes.
Wireless brakes don't yet exist, but maybe one day, who knows? Tom, go on. What's your judgment?
It has no place on any bike and it needs to die.
Right. Wow. Strong words there from Tom Law.
I see no benefits to it at all. It just annoys me. I recently tested the Scott Spark for the channel and the website, and I've doing some experimenting, swapping forks over. Something that should be so easy was so difficult. You know, you need like almost like three sets of hands to do everything. The Scott system is not great either because it uses like proprietary headset spacers as well. I know some other bikes, they actually go through the headset top cap, which is a little bit better if I had to be really pushed to speak of something positive about it. But yeah, no, please make it disappear. Tube and tube was just about okay from an aesthetic point of view. Yeah, just make it go away, please.
In the interests of BBC balance, although we're not the BBC, but we should always be balanced, there are some positive arguments for through the headset routing. One, you don't have to put a hole in the side of your head tube, which, you know, whether it causes problems or not, is extra engineering. It is potentially a little bit extra weight, and it does mean that, you know, there's a bit more time and effort having to be put into that. Less cable rub. Now, if you've got your tube in tube or your internal cable routing port in a place that isn't designed very well, you are going to get some cable rub. I've seen it on plenty of bikes, making those paintworks look terrible. Aesthetics, it does look better, especially with those. It looks great. Again, especially with wireless and those new stealth rooted brakes, where the brake master piston is more in line with the handlebars. does look super clean if you've got very few cables rattling around at the front of your bike. And there's also an argument that I've heard, whether it's true or not, I don't really know, but it makes less interference between the cables and your steering, if that makes sense. So less resistance to your steering. I think that's a minor, a very, very minor benefit. But
on that, though, I also heard the claim that, you know, in the heat of a battle and you're rummaging for places, there's less cable to be pulled out. So, you know, you're not snapping bandages.
Yeah. So I have headset rooted cabling through my Merida long-term bike. I have worked on that bike a few times recently and it is a bit of a pain, I'm not going to lie, but it does look tidy. I still have more working to do because I my dropper post cable is too long, so it looks really silly poking out the front like that. That's a task for another day when I've got a bit more patience. Right, our final one. And yet again, you'll be surprised to hear that this again ties into the more technical nature of XC Racing, which I think is basically our major take home. XC Racing isn't boring anymore. It's great. It's technical. It's difficult. It's cool. It's fun to watch. You should watch it this weekend on whatever streaming service shows it. I forget the name of it. Discovery Plus in the UK. Don't know what it is in the US anymore. Chunky tyre clearance. Big tyres on XC bikes are a good thing, in my opinion. Nick, would you agree with that? Or do you hark back to those days of 2-inch or 1.8-inch mud spikes and skinny rubber?
It depends on what you're riding, I guess. If it's a super zippy course where it's not muddy and, you know, it's banked field, then, yeah, go super skinny. You're going to be pretty quick on those. But if you're going a bit more technical, like, you set the question up to be, I would, for sure... Why wouldn't you? More comfort, more grip, lower pressures, you know, running tubeless setups, less chance of puncturing. It just makes sense. It's following the strides that, you know, every other sort of discipline mountain biking has and using those gains. So why wouldn't you?
I've just finished riding some XC wheels recently. The Mika K1 Evo. I think they're 29mm internal width, which is really broad. You know, that's as wide as you get on an enduro wheel. And they work really well with like 2.4-inch tyres. My favourite tyre at the moment, bar none, except an ultra-soft Magic Mary on my trail bike, is Max's Recon Race in a 2.4 wide trail. What an incredible tyre. It's really beautiful. Like, it's got a skinny tread that's really low. It's quite densely packed, so it rolls super fast. But somehow they've engineered like this beautiful little shoulder that you just lean the bike a slightly bit and you've got tons of grip. And then because it's got that 120 TPI carcass, the tire's super supple. It's really comfortable, like noticeably more comfortable than the Schwalbe tire combo that I've got on another test bike at the moment, which is a Racing Ray and a Racing Ralph, both in their like lightweight racing things. But those Maxxis tires are so good. They're so comfortable. Stick them in the mud. Right, okay, they're not great because that tread isn't particularly aggressive. But on any other surface, whether it's fast rolling tarmac, whether it's hard pack, roots, rocks, even when they're greasy and wet, it's such a good tire. It blows me away every time. And obviously, if you want a bit more chunk, the standard Recon, again, absolutely brilliant, in my opinion. Tom, what are your thoughts on wider tires in XC? Are you happy to take that extra little bit of weight for the increased rolling resistance, the better comfort, the better grip? I think you can tell my thoughts.
Definitely. So, I mean, back in my XC Racing days, it was literally a race to the bottom, like who could get the lightest tires. Like, I mean, I didn't run them because they were too expensive for teenage me, but you could get like Maxxis Max Light 330s or something like that that were just stupidly light. Obviously 330 referring to the grams that they are. I mean, even like, I can't remember the last time I saw too many XC race tires under 700 grams each or that much under it. So they're getting on for double that weight. But like I say, that Recon Race is such a good tire. You know, it just grips really, really well. Even it's obviously until recently, it's not been, you know, available in one of their, you know, max speed sort of compounds. It's only been their dual compound sort of thing, but it's still so grippy and so fast rolling. Mm. And yeah, they just give you more comfort, more control. And again, it comes back, you know, like, yeah, a smaller tire might be a fraction quicker for those top guys. But if they get a line choice slightly wrong or they're absolutely knackered at the end of a race and they flat or they fall off because they're on skinny tires, then it doesn't matter that they've saved 10 seconds over the course of a race because a rolling drum, you know, rolling resistance drum says it saves them, you know, 0.2 of a watt. It doesn't matter because they're on the deck and they've broken a collarbone and that's their season over. Yeah. So yeah, for me, I think it's a massive benefit. You know, the pros massively outweigh any marginal cons, in my opinion. So, so for sure, I know. Although Pidcock did opt for a 2.2 Continental Race King tyre rather than, you know, sort of the more standard sort of 2.35 and the 2.4.
But he did have a fall as well.
He did have
He did have a fall. Yeah, case in point, exactly.
So it's all okay.
Yeah.
Lovely stuff. All right, guys, we have rattled through that article and talked about the world of XC racing. I think the themes are pretty common here. Cross-country tech is more technical. It's more interesting. The bikes are better. The bikes are almost, I mean, you could ride many of these XC bikes as your regular trail bike these days, really. Maybe with a few slight alterations. I would add wider bars, for example, and maybe you'd want some chunkier tyres if you are going to go and just razz around the woods. But generally speaking, XC bikes in 2023 are incredible machines that are incredibly fun to ride. And we're looking forward to reviewing as many more of them this year as we can. So I shall be, I think I've got one of the Cervelos on its way, actually, which I'm pretty stoked about.
Ooh, nice.
We're going to leave that there. Thank you ever so much, Tom. And thank you, Nick, for your insight, entertainment and expertise. It's really appreciated. If you've enjoyed this podcast, don't forget to subscribe if you haven't already. Share it with your friends because they might enjoy it too. And if you do have any questions, comments or suggestions for future podcasts or anything for our Tech Q&A podcast, don't forget our email address is podcast@bikeradar.com. Thanks ever so much for listening and we'll be back on Friday, twice a week. So thanks for listening. Thanks for listening to the Bike Radar podcast. If you've not done so already, please subscribe and share with your friends, or leave us a rating if you've enjoyed this episode.